Should I just start with that? Should I just start with it?
That's pretty good.
Welcome to the Redundant Placeholders, a podcast dedicated to exploring the world of bicycles and bike racing. Whether you're an avid cyclist, a weekend warrior, or just starting to get into the sport, we've got something for you. In each episode, we'll be discussing the latest news and trends in the world of cycling, sharing expert advice and training tips, interviewing top riders and industry insiders. So grab your helmet, hop on your bike, because it's time to hit the road with the Redundant Placeholder. I almost got all the way through it. Dane Cash, welcome to the show. Explain what on earth I just read to the audience here.
Taylor, you just read the intro to the Redundant Placeholders as written by ChatGPT, a language learning model from OpenAI that I think wrote a perfectly acceptable intro to the podcast. I feel like it just makes our lives a lot easier, although maybe telling the listeners this, now we can't really get away with it, but I thought it was fine. I grabbed your helmet, hop on your bike. I didn't even tell it any of the real specifics. I just said podcast with the Redundant Placeholders as the name, and it's about bicycles and bike racing. That's all I told it, and here we are.
Artificial intelligence is coming for us all. A little bit terrifying, slightly terrifying, but it's actually quite good. I mean, it's not good. Let's be clear. It's not good. It's extremely passable.
Fine.
It's extremely passable. It's like what I would, you know, bang out if I had 25 seconds to write an intro before we were starting to record.
I'm really impressed that it suggests that we're going to do expert advice, training tips, interview top riders and industry insiders. Like, I didn't tell any of that, and it's still new. That's generally what a cycling podcast is going to do.
There's a deep level of irony going on here, where we have a podcast called The Redundant Placeholders, and we're promoting the tool that is going to keep us redundant.
Yeah. Yes. That's what we do. We do irony. We do redundancy. Yeah.
Of course, that was Dave Rome. Dave.
Hello.
You're feeling a little sicky this morning.
I am.
Sorry to hear it.
I am. Yeah, sorry. I've got a filter on my mic, so everyone should be safe. But yeah, a little worse for wear.
Well, we actually do have a fair amount to talk about today. Thank you to everybody who's listened to our first, like 1.25 episodes. We had one real episode and one kind of not really real episode. We do appreciate all of you. Actually, the number of you that have already hit subscribe and downloaded this thing is kind of shocking to us. And we very much appreciate you seeking it out, because we also gave it a really stupid name that could be kind of hard to find in whatever your favorite podcast thing is. So we appreciate you. Thank you very much. Well, let's get into today's non-AI bit of the podcast. We're speaking with somebody tomorrow who works in this space and actually is a longtime listener of our podcast, a cyclist, and works in the AI space. And because we want to find out just like where exactly this is going, specifically related to cycling and bike racing, and the potential uses within bike racing, but also the potential uses within bicycle media.
How do you be a longtime listener of the podcast when we've had two episodes?
He's question. Been there since two episodes ago.
Okay, just
Dave.
Checking. Yep.
Yeah, 100% yeah. of the episodes.
Like, all right. 100% of the episodes.
That's pretty loyal.
Yeah. Yeah, friend. I would call him a friend of the podcast at this point. I mean, if you've listened to every single episode, you must be a friend of the podcast.
Thank
right?
you. Thank you for your loyalty.
Yeah. Well, let's get into it. Let's get into today's show. We've got a fair amount to talk about. So I feel like last week we rocked up. We were a little shell-shocked still from losing, well, Dave and I losing our jobs. We managed to pull an episode together, which we hope you enjoyed. But there wasn't actually that much to talk about. And this week, there's a lot to talk about. There is a long list of things to talk about. So we're gonna kick off with some discussion of the men in Glaz and an update on the Cav situation, because I know we were talking about that last week. We've also got news from the Tour de France, and specifically the finish of the 2024 Tour, which is not going to finish in Paris. I'm sure you've seen this news, but you know, we'll take a little recollection back to 1989, the last time we had a time trial finish, which is the other notable thing about this 2024 finish. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about Remco's final decision to race the Giro d'Italia. We're going to get into a little bit of unfortunate news on a couple different fronts. First and foremost will be some relatively large layoffs at Wahoo, the maker of trainers and head units and things like that. We have a bit more insight into those layoffs and the health of that company, which is a little bit, well, it's not good news. I'll tell you that right now. We'll get to that in a little bit. And the incredibly, incredibly sad news that Davide Rebellin was killed by a truck driver while training in Italy last week. Well, I guess we start there. I'm finishing there. I'm starting there. Yeah, this news came across last week. It was a hit and run. And the latest is that the driver has been found in Germany. And they are attempting to extradite him because I guess the specific statute that he would be arrested under in Italy maybe he like doesn't exist in its exact form in Germany or something like that. Anyway, they found the guy. He has a history of hit and runs, so who knows how he still has a license and is still driving a very large truck. But yeah, they are attempting to bring him to justice sometime soon. Now, Davide Rebellin obviously has a somewhat checkered past, did serve a doping ban connected with the 2008 Olympic Games, but is also one of the longest riding professional cyclists in the history of the sport. I mean, he got his start in the mid-90s and only retired a month ago as a 51-year-old. So I guess the doping stuff aside, as a human being, and we aren't talking about the loss of a human being here, it's just incredibly, incredibly sad because he was, in a lot of ways, I think a pretty good reflection of a lot of amateur cyclists in that he just loved it. He just absolutely loved bike racing, loved riding his bike. You cannot race your bike from 1994, I believe it was, professionally, or 96, to 2022 without absolutely being in love with it. And I think that regardless of what you think of his doping or what you think of various pieces of his career, I think we can all appreciate that. That is something that pulls us all together. So incredibly sad. He was always an absolute gentleman whenever I dealt with him. And in his last couple of years racing here, he was racing for lower division teams. And we're talking about a rider who was touted as one of the absolute stars of Italian cycling in the late 90s, early 2000s, who by the end of his career was racing for tiny little teams, you know, and tiny little races in Asia and things like that, and still absolutely loving it. So our condolences to anybody who knew him better than us, friends and family and everybody else. And I don't know. That truck driver sucks. I hope he gets the book thrown at him.
Having things on your record like that, it just shouldn't happen. I mean, you shouldn't be somebody that has a history like that. So hopefully this is the end.
Yeah, it's shocking to me that you can do something like that and then have a driver's license again. That doesn't make any sense to me at all. But we'll leave that angry little note aside. I did want to spend a fair amount of time here on Mark Cavendish, because it is really been kind of the story of the fall. So Dane, what is going on with the men in Glas? What are the updates at B&B Hotels?
Well, they're not good. Since last week, the news has turned worse. Essentially, any hope that team was going to continue, that funding might be found, whatever, has, you know, kind of fallen through. And we've now learned that the team, the B&B Hotel squad, is done. They are not going to continue, at least in their current form. The money's not there, so the riders are free to look elsewhere that were signed with the team. And then, of course, Cavendish never officially announced, but, you know, our understanding by reading all the reports was that he had been expecting to be announced as a rider for this team. Right up until all of a sudden that wasn't going to happen. And now it seems as if he's back out there. Of course, the tough thing for Cavendish and for Quintana, as we mentioned, Nairo Quintana last week, this is really late in the season to find a team. And it's one thing to be Ramon Cinkeldam, who, you know, just signed with Alpecin de Kooning apparently yesterday. probably not going to command a huge salary. If you're Mark Cavendish, probably expecting a fair bit of money and, you know, a fair bit of hoopla around your signing. It's pretty late in the year for that. So he's going to have a hard time, I think, finding the team that's going to shell out for what he's probably worth as a rider who can contend for Tour de France stage wins. That said, I can think of plenty of squads who would definitely benefit from having a rider of his caliber leading the way in the sprints next year. And I'm hoping that he's going to find a spot at one of those teams, because I think it's such a big story in cycling. I mean, when we write about it, as you know, bike journalists or talk about it, people want to know. People want to know what Cavendish is up to. They want to know if he's going to break that record, because, of course, he's currently tied with Eddie Merckx on Tour de France stage wins.
Yeah, I mean, I have to imagine that his contract's going to be structured such that his actual salary is relatively low, maybe almost nothing, and it's full of essentially riders that would pay him out if he does good things, right? It's probably a pretty big payout if he gets that record-breaking stage win at the Tour de France, for example. That's how his contracts have been structured the last few years, actually. Starting back with his return to Quickstep, that was a relatively it was kind of a low-risk thing for Patrick Lefebvre at the time. And I believe that even a lot of his, if he did get those payouts, if he did do the things that were in his contract, hit those markers, a lot of that payment would actually come from other sponsors as well, like Specialized and things like that. So I would imagine that that's the way that he's looking at doing this. But I mean, we're nearing the end of the year here, and we'll at some point have to face up to the potential reality of Mark Cavendish being forced to retire in quite unfortunate manner. And I'm still personally holding out hope that doesn't happen. I'm sure most fans out there probably are as well. But that is, with every day, an increasing possibility.
You mentioned Specialized being part of contracts in the past. Of course, they've also been involved in paying a number of riders who they've signed, big names who have signed with teams that they provide bikes for. And I think, to me, that says, as hard as it's going to be for Cavendish to find a team willing to shell out, think of all of the sort of not Specialized bike brands who are going to be excited about the opportunity to say, Mark Cavendish broke the record for Tour de France stage wins on our bike. And I think that hopefully will inspire some team or some brand to shell out some cash with that possibility out there. And maybe it's not somebody that's at the funding level of a Specialized, because that could be a big deal for any brand. I mean, that's just a great thing to have on your resume, no matter what bike brand
you are.
Question
is, does anybody in the bike industry have any money right now? We'll get into that with the Wahoo discussion a bit later. There's not a whole lot of slush fund floating around, I think, in the bike world and frankly in the broader economy at this point. Well, we will see. We'll leave the Cav discussion there. We've discussed at length what we think he should do or what we hope happens. So at this point, we are just waiting. Well, wins on the Champs brings me to our next topic, and a lack thereof, in 2024. The Tour de France will be finishing in Nice in 2024. This is due to the Paris Olympic Games happening around the same time, and I would assume like police issues or some other road closure issue or something like that that is preventing them from being able to finish this thing in Paris on the Champs-Élysées as they normally do. Dane, what's the story? What's the finish going to look like?
It's going to be a TT in Nice, which...
Finishing in Nice. Cool. Starting in Monaco, which is interesting.
And it'll be beautiful, I'm sure. Nothing like riding along the Riviera. A lot of cyclists who are going to be racing the Tour de France, of course, live in that area. It's a very popular place for pros to live. And we see TTs in the kind of Nice-Monaco area all the time because Paris-Nice goes down there. So if you're someone who likes TTs, if you're someone who has fond memories of specific, very close Tour de France time trial battle 30 years ago, if you don't like sprints, I think you're pretty happy. If you're somebody who likes the sprint on the Champs-Élysées, this is going to be a bit of a change, a big change, actually.
Do you like a final day time trial? Because like the moving it out of Paris is one thing. I don't know. It's a bit of a bummer because that Paris finish is so iconic. But at the end of the day, it's 1 year. I think it'll be kind of cool to finish it in Nice. Great. That's a lesser story to me than the fact that it's going to finish with a time trial for the first time since 1989. And as you alluded to, we can all, if not remember ourselves, and have probably read at some point about the time trial finish in 1989 when Laurent Fignon had the yellow jersey ripped off his shoulders by one American, Greg LeMond, by 8 seconds. So how do we feel about a TT finish?
I'm personally pretty excited about it because it's always, for me, the Tour de France has always been a 20-day race, right? With a weird criterium at the end of it, almost. A camis. You know, a celebration and then a short sprint. So I think to have a genuine 21-day long Grand Tour is exciting for me. And I guess I'm young enough that I didn't watch that the last time that it did end in a Tour de France. I've certainly seen highlights of it. But yeah, I think it actually turns the race into exactly what it's always claimed to be. And it's now a genuine 3-week long race.
Yeah, I remember watching it when I was 4 months old in a bar and just really, it was fantastic. It was stellar.
I won't ask you what you're drinking at that point.
As a one-off, I'm okay with it. But I like the Champs-Élysées being sort of the Super Bowl / World Series / insert sports analogy here of sprinting. I really like that. So I'm only okay with this kind of as a one-off. I think it's a cool idea. And I think if we get a 1989, or if we get the time trial that Tadej Pogacar, you know, overhauled Primož Roglič, and that time trial was incredible and everybody went bonkers that day, that'll be very exciting. I think there is the risk of it being, you know, a rider who's leading the race by 4 minutes ends the race with a 6-minute lead, which is not the most exciting thing in the world.
No. And we don't have the exact route, I should say, route for this time trial. We know it starts in Monaco. We know it ends in Nice. There's a fair amount of coastline in between there. There's also a fair number of mountains in between there. I mean, hell, they could send them up the Col de la Madone if they really wanted to. That's right there. Generally, when Paris-Nice has run TTs down there, they run up and over Col d'Huez, and it's a pretty good little hill. It's obviously much more difficult on a TT bike. It's a good time trial bike climb, though. It's kind of like sits right at the intersection between, oh, we should probably be on a road bike, and no, you can stay on a TT bike, right? Like, it's not crazy steep. Doesn't have like a ton of corners in it. There's a lot of roads around there that are really tiny and steep and nasty. Col d'Huez is it's not quite a highway, but it's not quite, not too far off. So it wouldn't surprise me if they do that. If we see like a Col d'Huez loop or something like that, you start in Monaco, do a Col d'Huez loop, finish down on was it the Place des Anglais? Is that that's the big road down in Nice, right?
I'm kind of looking
forward to it. Again, I'm also glad that it's hopefully a one-off, because I also like the Champs finish. I personally love being there every year. It's one of the highlights of my last, you know, 10, 12 years of bicycle journalism career. But I'm just interested to see what they do with the route and then what effect that has on the race, because they also mentioned that the previous stage is going to be in and around Nice, which means that we're pretty much guaranteed something at least relatively hilly, if not hugely mountainous, at least relatively hilly. I mean, like I said, you could have a Col de la Madone or something like that. There's a bunch of Col de Brousses down there. There's a bunch of really good climbs in and out of Nice that they could use if they wanted to, and could make essentially the last 2 days of the tour incredibly difficult and incredibly important. Now, again, if there's already a 5-minute lead, it's not really probably going to have a huge amount of impact. But if it's close in any way to go that far into the race with that much riding on it, it's a big deal, and it could be pretty exciting.
I've got 2 points. The first is that if they do end up doing the Col d'Huez, I just remember that Richie Porte is really good on that thing, and I want him to race the Tour de France. I want to see what he does. 2024, Richie Porte, I'm all in if they do go up the Col d'Huez. That's the first point. The second point is that he's muted right now, and the listeners don't know this because we're able to see what's happening, but Dave Rome is coughing. He's blowing his nose. He's putting everything into this podcast, and I want the listeners to understand just how hard he's working for you right now. He's in this. You know, he's giving it his all.
My heart rate is maxed out, and I'm really struggling to breathe as we're talking about getting up these climbs. I don't know if I'm going to make it.
Are you muting? You're muting us, Dave, but are you muting your actual mic? Or
oh, no,
this,
you've
am I
got...
Gonna have to, oh, good.
Yeah, so you've got a lot of editing. Sniffles. Yeah. But the good news is I'm not saying a whole lot, so... I'm sorry.
We'll get to the tech bit. We'll get to the tech
bit
later.
I did say I was sick, and you're like, ah, you'll be fine. I'm like, all right.
You'll be fine. Yeah. Well, let's be honest here. If you're out, Dave, we don't have a podcast. Mm. Then it's just Dane and I talking to each other.
We just gotta talk.
That's not great. It's not a good scene.
Yeah.
This is the problem with a fledgling podcast empire. Is that at the moment it's only three of us.
two and a half of you today. People. Yeah.
Well, maybe this is a good opportunity, Dane, to plug something.
Oh
yeah. So we've just been since Dave and I got laid off. And Dane's just been waiting around for us for months post layoffs. The three of us, we've been doing some chats over the last week, 10 days, trying to figure out what to do here. And we have some ideas. And I'm going to leave the details of most of it to an episode in the near future. But we can today release the fact that we have been in discussions with none other than Cosmo Catalano. Some of you will know him from his How the Race Was Won series. Some of you will know him from a podcast that he did with Dane Cash back in the day called The Recon Ride, which I was always a fan of. We are heavily considering some kind of racing preview Recon Redux podcast to add to our enormous podcast empire here pretty soon. I think we're probably going to wait till the new year, but because there's not been a whole lot of racing right now, we continue to ignore the existence of cyclocross, much to Cosmo's chagrin. But yeah, I think that's coming. Right, Dane? Have we decided that?
Sources report. Yeah, that's what my sources say.
Sources indicate.
Sources indicate that there's something brewing. It's very exciting. We'll have to follow that story.
The redundant placeholders understand.
you hinted last week, I think you called that we would say, I think you said something along the lines of that we would have the best cycling podcast network hands down. I think I thought that was a pretty bold claim, but it's looking more and more likely.
It's looking a lot more likely.
Yeah.
Gotta start. Yeah. You gotta start with a bold idea and then you start drawing in talent, you know? That's how that works.
Start with a terrible name. And then build from there. So yeah, keep an eye out for that. Again, I don't want to dive into too many details yet because, I mean, frankly, some of the contract stipulations that Cosmo has demanded are just out of this world, Dane. And I'm not sure if we can actually...
M&M colors, only blue M&Ms.
It's wild stuff. It's wild. So I'm not sure we can get it across the line.
Yeah.
And so I don't want to promise anything, but that's currently what we're working towards right now. Just so everybody out there knows.
What's the reason behind wanting to record every episode in a McDonald's playroom?
Oh, that's me.
Oh, okay.
That's my stipulation. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I'm hoping to get that McDonald's sponsorship.
Gotcha. That's what it was. Okay. I was confused by that one. But anyway.
It's where Dane feels most at home.
Yes. Yeah.
We have a couple more things to talk about, gentlemen. Not that much, actually. We have Remco news. So I'm having trouble remembering what we talked about on this podcast and what was talked about on some other podcast. But I don't think we talked about this yet, which is correct. That I mean like over the course of the entire fall here, Remco Evenepoel is going to be racing the Giro d'Italia. And there was some back and forth about this, a fair amount of back and forth about this, actually. In fact, myself and a former colleague had a heated debate about whether we thought this was a good idea or not. I said that he should go straight to the Tour de France. Why waste a year? Dane clearly agrees with me, and so now we're gonna agree fight with each other.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So
I mean, like, we could like try to take differing opinions, but I to me it's just so obvious he should go to the Tour de France, yeah, that I don't know, I'd be really half-hearted.
I mean, I do think that, well, the Giro has done this a fair amount in recent years, right? Like, they have tailored a course for an individual they want to show up, and I'm sure that they have done other things to attempt to ensure that that individual has shown up. And it worked this time. They are going to get Remco at the start line, and it's a Giro route that suits him pretty darn well. Lots of time trial kilometers. There's not really anybody else that is at least at this point slated to start the Giro that you would put ahead of him. He comes into it as the heavy favorite, which he's going to like, and frankly, like, it could extend his Grand Tour win run to two here, and maybe then he goes to the Tour de France anyway, but we can leave that for a later time.
One thing that I, like, one reason it's not as bad as if it were any other guy who just won a Vuelta and a world title is how young he is. He's still only 22 years old. The fact that he's still only 22 years old to me says he's got time to go to the Tour de France. In general, I prefer to see the very, very best at the Tour de France. And I don't love seeing them go to the Giro. And then even if he shows up the Tour, he's not going to be in the same shape as if he hadn't graced the Giro. But he's 22. I mean, he's got so much, one would think, time ahead of him to continue to grow and thrive and have great success. So at least there's that. I'm sure it'll be a blast for him. The Giro is just a cool environment, and it's got its own history, it's its own thing. We're gonna miss out, I think, if he goes to the Giro, seeing him at his very best racing the Tour de France, which is what I think we want from the world champ and a potential Grand Tour contender.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things we discussed previously on a different podcast was that there's just so much pressure on him because of where he's from. And he's just been the golden child for so long, right? And from that perspective, another year to mature before he goes to the Tour, and perhaps even just sort of making sure that he is a true Tour contender before showing up, maybe would take a bit of pressure off, I think. I mean, he's done a number of things to try to take pressure off, in particular since winning the World Championships in Australia in the fall. He's moved to Spain first and foremost. He's hanging out in Spain. I think in Alicante is where he moved to. So he got out of Belgium completely. There's a couple quotes that were floating around about, like, not being able to go to the grocery store anymore and things like that in Belgium. So not too surprising that he'd want to get out of that and get into Spain. Also built an altitude room in his new home in Spain, so he can just altitude sleep all year round. It's an interesting one. Yeah. Taking the altitude stuff to a whole new... I mean, it's not the first time athletes have done that, of course. Altitude tents have been around for a long time. And I think... I'm trying to remember. Was it Froome that put one in? I'd have to look that up. Don't quote me on that. Some GC contender in the last couple of years has installed one of these in their home already. Anyway, Remco's, yeah, moved to Spain, built an altitude room, racing the Giro. So he's taking things step by step, and I see the logic in it, right? Like, I see why you would want to take the stepping stone of Vuelta, Giro, Tour de France, right? It is the traditional stepping stone for young riders, and it's only in the last couple of years that those stepping stones have been thrown aside in large part, right? Like, it's only in the last couple of years that the super talents just show up at 20 years old and immediately race the Tour de France and try to win it, like Tadej Pogacar or Egan Bernal, right? So in some ways, maybe it's a good thing. It's the team being careful with him, or whoever handles him being careful with him, or maybe it's him being careful with him. I don't want to discount the fact that the man does have free will and can decide what he wants to do to some extent. And that is apparently race the Giro. Well, before we continue today's episode, we have a sponsor today. Are you ready to elevate your cycling to the next level? Introducing the most advanced cycling technology on the market, the Quantum Bike. Using cutting-edge quantum mechanics, This bike allows you to harness the power of the universe and ride at speeds never before thought possible. With its sleek design and unmatched performance, this bike is perfect for the most dedicated and adventurous cyclists. Don't miss out on this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Order your Quantum bike today and experience the future of cycling.
Kayleigh, I have questions. Is this the Quantum Bikes that's the bike shop in Perth? Is it the e-bike company out of Canada? Or is it the... what else did I find? The custom frame building company. Yeah, out of England.
Clearly, it's the e-bike company out of Canada.
Right.
no, it is none of the
above. Don't say that. We're going to get sued.
It's not. That is... So I asked ChatGPT, the AI robot. I said, can you write me ad copy for an esoteric cycling product?
Did it give it the, name and quantum? It came up with the quantum.
It came up with all 100% of that. That was the only input was give me ad copy for an esoteric cycling product. I wonder how did we get to quantum mechanics from esoteric cycling product?
I don't know, but I'm in. I want that bike.
It sounds sweet.
I want to reach speeds never before thought possible.
So if you're, you know, an advertiser out there, if you would like to advertise in this podcast, the ground rule is that all you have to do is you send us one quick line about your product, and then we let AI do the rest. we see what we come up with. No, we won't do that. We also are not taking advertisers yet. Well, let's get into today's geek warning. Dave Vroom, we have a couple bits of news here.
Some more geek related than others, I think. But yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So do we want to start with the unfortunate Wahoo stuff? Layoff stuff?
Yeah. It seems, Kayleigh, you and I weren't the only ones to be laid off in the last few weeks, which is not great. But yeah, it seems there's a bit of downsizing happening in a few segments of cycling at the moment. And Wahoo certainly seems to be one of them. Funnily enough, I haven't been able to find much on this other than your Twitter post, Kayleigh. You seem to be the only reporter reporting on this. Reddit has...
I don't know where else to write it, so I just tweet it.
I found it on Reddit, but all they've done is screenshot your Twitter post. Mm. So, yeah, I mean, what's happened here?
Well, so here's what happened. Is last week, I got notice from a couple different folks who work at Wahoo around the same time, because I think all these layoffs, that's the way these things work, right? Like everybody gets a 15-minute phone call scheduled in their calendar, and they're like, ah, shit. And then people start texting me. So heard about these in the morning, and what was it, like last Wednesday or Tuesday morning or something like that? And it quickly became apparent that it was quite a large layoff. So it's roughly 16% of Wahoo's staff. I think it was 43 people or something like that. I'm still not exactly sure which segments of the company were most affected. But the bigger issue here, when I started to sort of poke around a little bit more, put my reporter hat and dig a little bit, and actually with the help of a friendly listener out there who works in finance, because this stuff is well outside my wheelhouse, dug in a little bit and into sort of the health of Wahoo as a company. And I regret to inform listeners out there that it does not look good. And when I say regret, I mean, I truly mean that. Yeah. Like I have really enjoyed watching Wahoo rise over the last couple years. Yeah. Yeah, as a real competitor to Garmin, I own a lot of these things. I think they make a fantastic product in a lot of different places. There have been some missteps.
They've forced genuine product innovation from many others other than themselves through just creating great product. So yeah, I mean, they, and there's good people behind that. So yeah, it is sad to see them struggling now.
Yeah, which is, I mean, that's the greatest compliment you can give a company, right? And you force others to adapt to them. But yeah, the long and short of it is that according to a Moody's report, Moody's is a credit rating research data aggregator thing for the finance world and for the business world, and they provide, like I said, credit ratings. So Wahoo's credit rating was downgraded to what I believe is the lowest available option. This is not my wheelhouse here, but I know enough to, know that that's very bad.
I mean, fundamentally, they're completely over-leveraged and out of cash is the issue at hand here, right? It's
Yes. That's a succinct way to put it,
yeah.
Dave.
Yeah.
The Wahoo was purchased in a leveraged buyout by Rhône Capital. Rhône is in like the Rhône Valley in France, R-H-O-N-E, in 2021. And essentially that came with a bunch of debt that got dumped onto Wahoo. Extremely weak 2022. EBITDA was down by 80% versus 2021. That's very bad.
It's
extremely
good.
Bad. Means that basically the sort of the current situation is completely unsustainable. The leverage is completely unsustainable, and a restructuring, as it is called in the space, or in other words, like Chapter 11 bankruptcy or similar, is quite likely, according to Moody's. Again, this is not stuff that I'm just making up. This is one of the largest credit authorities on the planet saying all this stuff. Now, Wahoo is a privately owned company, so we don't have super detailed financial statements and things like that, but it seems clear here that, one, these layoffs were, unfortunately, very necessary for a whole number of reasons, and two, still may not be the end of Wahoo's troubles, and I think that for folks like Dave and myself, who are just fans of this company, yeah. That's a really unfortunate situation.
And the writing's been on the wall for a little bit. I think in March or April, they had about 50 people laid off as well. But what was interesting then, that came at the same time as an acquisition of RGT, the online platform, which was sort of designed to bolster their answer to Zwift, you know, to create this like wholly integrated, vertically integrated platform for Wahoo. It's an interesting time that they've basically absorbed a lot of these companies and grown this online platform, and now it's clearly they're having to revert back to their core product, which is, you know, trainers and computers, which is where they came from. I'm speculating here, but I think that's really, if or when they restructure from being completely overleveraged, I think we'll really see those online platforms be the first to go, or really be the ones that get cut, where they can't be invested in.
Yeah, and again, we don't want to speculate too hard here. Yeah. I mean, this is one. It's a company we like. It's people that we know. It's people that make a really good product, and we hope that they can dig themselves out of this. The causes are, I mean, you probably get a fair amount of debate in finance circles as to the exact causes. You know, there was that leverage buyout. Now, Rhône Capital didn't go into this attempting to bring the equity of the thing they bought to zero, which is where they're at now. So, you know, it's sort of hard to like look at it as like a nefarious thing, although leverage buyouts do have a pretty bad reputation generally. It feels more like it's just some terrible, terrible timing and a lack of vision as to, you know, how the pandemic would end, right?
Yep.
If they're purchased under the circumstances of 2020, 2021, and then, you know, EBITDA is down 80% year over year, they're looking at being leveraged to the tune of 18x by the end of 2022, according to Moody's. Like, these are bad, bad, bad numbers. I'm not a finance person. And so, first of all, I apologize to the finance people out there for using these terms wrong. But this is my understanding of it. And I guess we're hoping for the best here. I was just kind of shocked to see just how bad the situation is. Well, I was going to say we can move into lighter news, but Strava also had layoffs last week. I don't know exactly how large those were. A couple folks who were laid off reached out. I do not believe they were as extensive in terms of as a percentage of the company as Wahoo, and I do not have any similar doom and gloom news about the finances of Strava. So I don't have any additional reporting to bring you on that particular one. But yeah, more layoffs in the bike world, which is never a good thing.
Feels shitty.
Hmm. You know, as a laid off person.
Yes.
Tell you right now, it's less than ideal. Although it does let you start stupid podcasts with your friends. So that's what I would suggest to everybody at Strava and Wahoo. Everybody go start a podcast. Well, so our real geek warning today, our you know, true to form Greek warning. Warning, there's the Greeks are coming.
No, it's a Rome warning. It's a Rome warning.
Oh, Dane. That's 11 out of 10 points, I believe, is what you just received. That is superb.
A joke of the times.
Dave Rome, we want to talk about handlebars and something that you have kind of discovered through a little personal testing.
It's not even a new discovery. It's something that whenever I've done bike reviews over recent years, it's been at the front of mind, but I think it's still completely underrated, and that is comfortable handlebars, or handlebars that aren't rigid and uncomfortable in terms of vibration control. So some would say flexi handlebars is probably what I'm wanting to talk about. And if we step back a decade or more, our handlebar diameters, where it clamped on the stem, was 26 millimeters is the diameter, or 25.4 for mountain bikes. That was the standard, and that inherently was flexier than where the industry went, which is to an oversized system, 31.8. Recently I've been paying more and more attention to this, because there's a lot of attention given to C-posts, flexible C-posts that sort of are designed to be flexible and give you a nice comfortable place to sit down on and absorb those bumps. But most people seem to ignore the fact that those C-posts only work while you're seated, but a handlebar can do much the same anytime you're holding on to the handlebars.
Which is most of the time.
Exactly. And yeah, I look back and I think about all the bikes that I've complimented for having a really nice balanced ride quality front to back. Pretty much all of them had a handlebar which had some sort of visible amount of flex to it. And I was reminded of this fact very recently in the last week or so. I bought myself a new gravel bike very recently. It was a gravel bike I tested a year ago, a 51 Assassin, which in my review, I commented that one of the things I didn't like about it was it had an overly rigid ride quality that I felt could be fixed with different components. And I've been doing that to my own. So I've got a nice Ergon, the leaf spring seat post, the same one that Canyon uses in the back. And then the front, I initially had just played with a few different handlebars to figure out shape, and I was using an entry-level Eastern Alloy handlebar. And my hands were going numb and getting really painful, and I was just feeling like I was being rattled. So I went ahead and started playing with carbon handlebars, and I've got a Roval Terra handlebar on there now. And it's night and day different to how that bike rides. And it's something that I think a lot of people and even brands are still overlooking. I think it's something that people should start thinking about.
I 100% agree.
Yeah.
In fact, I've noticed it. So both my mountain bike bars are 35.
Yep.
And I don't really get it.
No.
Like, I've got on one bike 120 mil of travel, and another bike 180.
Yep.
70. So I'm looking for squish up front. Yeah. Clearly, like I'm not running a rigid single speed here. And then I've got this insanely stiff carbon 35 mil handlebar. Yeah. And I've actually been getting like hand fatigue.
Yep.
That I don't remember getting.
Yep.
Previously,
because it's a different
kind of. I'm riding similar trails and like, I'm genuinely considering it, at the very least going down to a 31.6.
Yeah, so. And I did that exact thing on my cross-country hardtail recently, which I got a new bike not that long ago in that segment, and I purposely hunted down a 31.8 handlebar and stem for that reason. And then on my trail bike, I'm using a one-up carbon handlebar, which their whole shtick as far as a product design is that it's a 35 millimeter handlebar that is designed to be as flexible as a 31.8. Like, that's the entire claim around that bar. And it makes a difference. I swapped from a regular... actually, it was a carbon 35 mil handlebar, and I went to this one-up. And yeah, my hands, like, I got less arm pump. I got less hand fatigue. It's yeah, this isn't just a rigid gravel bike thing. This is all segments of cycling. And I think,
I often come back to the fact that one of the best riding bikes I have ever been on, and I mean ever, was a not particularly expensive Mozzie steel frame that I stuck some Zip 303s on from the Velonews tech room back in the day, and like kind of made it into like a steel racing bike. You know, 27.2 C-post, skinny steel tubes, steel fork as well. Rode like an absolute dream. I'm not sure that I'd want to like race crits on it.
Yep.
But man, just riding it was so nice, and it cornered really, really well, and descended really, really well, and super lively, like really lively feel. And I haven't ridden a bike sort of like that since. And actually, like, I almost considered going steel for my custom travel bike for a while. The only reason I didn't is because you have to paint steel, and I put this bike in a very small bag on a regular basis, and it would get scratched to hell.
Especially the way you paint it, with the way you pack it.
Yes, exactly, with the way I pack it. Meaning, you know, I do it in about 8 minutes before a flight.
So I've been
searching for this ride quality again, and I sometimes wonder if the bike world just needs to go backwards a little bit, and, you know, not go back to a bike from 1987. Like, I still want the good shifting, and I want 12 speed, and I want nice carbon wheels that are stiff and fun and light, but I think that the rest of the package can be a bit softer and feel quite nice.
I mean, this is a big topic, but this is exactly why Richie bikes are praised to this day for having an amazing ride quality, is that simply they're flexier than everyone else's modern bikes. You know, everyone else has gone to these oversized fork steerers with, you know, this very large bearing diameter that just adds stiffness, and Richie's still stuck with a narrower straight steerer tube, which is more flexible. But yeah, to overcome all these additional levels of stiffness that have been built into the bikes, like, you know, forks for disc brakes have to handle different forces and are typically stiffer than what a rim brake fork was. So yeah, that's, I guess my point is, bikes are much stiffer than they used to be. The ride quality has kind of been lost, and I think people can gain it back by looking at their handlebar. Or gain some of it back, at least.
There you go.
Thank you.
Is that a bicycling tip, Dave?
It might be. It might be a bicycling suggestion.
I like Rome warning.
A Rome warning?
Yeah, I like that the best.
All right. It's time to go. I did not have AI write us an outro. Maybe I should have. Instead, I'm just going to do what I always do and say thank you, Dane Cash, for joining on the show today.
Thank you, Kale.
They can't see you. Salute.
Thank you, Kaylee. Saluting you, waving, all those things.
I listened to another podcast where it was, I think it was Visible Disability Month in November. And so they described themselves at the beginning of the podcast, which I thought was actually quite cool. So maybe we'll do that at some point. But not right now, because we're not prepared to do that. Anyway, we expect that sometime soon. Thank you, Dave Rome, for joining on the episode.
Thank you. Thank you.
We will be back with another one next week, because we're very much enjoying this, and we hope you are as well.
And we've got nothing else to do, so we may as well.
We have literally nothing else to do. All right. Thanks, everybody. Before I go. Thank you, double, triple, quadruple thank you to everybody who has left us a rating and a review on iTunes or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. It's actually extremely helpful because it tricks the algorithms into pushing us in front of more people. So the fact that we have grown quite quickly here, and the fact that we're getting lots and lots of ratings and reviews quite quickly here, means that we've actually shown up on some of the sort of like new and interesting pages on for people. So that's really cool. And thank you to all of you who are doing that, because it's working.
Could I ask a favor, which is, this is a very niche request, but if you have a friend that's into cycling and has been laid off from their job in no predetermined time frame, tell them about our podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah. There you go.
Make sure they know.
Yeah, please do.
All right. Bye, everybody.
See ya.
See ya.